Hello, and welcome to Beyond Organic Wine. I'm Adam Huss, coming to you from Piscinas, California. Thank you so much for listening. I have a small correction to issue from the last episode about Foxy Wine, which you should definitely listen to if you haven't already. While I was critiquing the wiki entry about the Isabella grape in that episode, I didn't realize that the way the wiki referred to it as Vitis X Labruscana, and which I described as nonsense, is the accepted way of describing any hybrid grapes that have Vitis Labrusca in their parentage. So it actually makes sense within this naming convention. However, the critique of that wiki entry as extremely viniferous chauvinistic still stands as a whole, and it really should be rewritten. And while that naming convention may be accepted, I'm still pretty convinced that it arises out of a strange and likely prejudiced perspective on grapes. But maybe Labrusca grapes should take pride that even when a grape is less than half Labrusca, it will still be referred to as Labruscana. Labruscana have a lot to be proud of already anyway, being the most popular grapes on planet Earth. I want to thank Colton Pro, who I'm fortunate to work with here at Piscinas Ranch, for pointing out my mistake and giving me this opportunity to learn something. I've talked a lot on the podcast about this idea of being wrong and changing my mind regularly. More and more, this makes me want to talk about actual observed data, real life experiences, and the questions that we still don't have answers to. It seems that what we don't know outweighs what we do know by a significant amount, and I'm finding more and more the answers to many questions is it depends. The details of your specific situation must be considered in the application of any theory, and recipes must always be adapted. This is why observing carefully, listening, and learning from your ecosystem and its inhabitants is so important. At the recent regenerative wine growing immersion that happened here at Piscinas Ranch, we learned a lot about holistic management. One of the reasons I find learning about holistic management to be valuable is because one of its principal tenets is to assume that you are wrong when you take any action on the land. Think about how different that is from the norm and how that changes the way you farm. If we assume we're wrong, we will more carefully observe. We will start smaller, less impactfully, less invasively. We will do tests and trials to get feedback. We will want feedback. We will have a mental predisposition to accept corrections, and we'll continually be open to learning. We will look critically at our own ideas and plan for adaptation. I definitely suggest learning more about holistic management, but if you take nothing else from it, I don't think you can go wrong by embracing the principle of assuming that you are wrong, because as I've learned, no matter how careful you are, you can still make mistakes, and we need each other to learn. We can't see our own backsides. Well, at least not without two mirrors, but it's much more fun to have a friend tell you about your backside. My guest for this episode is Nick Hillman. Nick has worked with vineyards on three continents, including all across the United States. Nick now lives in and does vineyard and farm consultation in Texas with his company, Regenerative Agriculture Solutions. Nick has been on a journey that led him from conventional recipe-type viticulture to a transformed regenerative outlook and approach. He tells us about the ideas and experiences that began to make him ask harder questions, the things that didn't make sense or seem wise. We get technical about integrated pest management, or IPM, as well as the pros and cons of VSP versus high trellis systems, dormant spraying for the most effect and least impact, and Texas AVAs. Along the way, Nick digs into what regenerative viticulture is all about and why it has grabbed him and led him on this journey. Enjoy. Countdown, Nick, welcome. Thanks. Thanks for talking.
Adam, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the invitation to come onto your podcast.
Well, I really appreciate you doing it. And if you could introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do, what's your job, what's your path?
Yeah, definitely. So my name is Nick Hillman. I am a vineyard consultant based out of Fort Worth, Texas, originally from the big shiny state of California. I've been involved in the wine industry since probably about 2008. I started my schooling at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, 2007, 2008. Graduated in 2012 with a Bachelor's of Science in Wine and Vit with Viticulture emphasis, as well as Plant Protection Science minor for predominantly with Integrated Pest Management emphasis. I've had the opportunity over my career to work in a multitude of different growing regions, different AVAs and states in California, in the U.S., not just California, as well as an opportunity I had in, I worked briefly in France on the left bank of Bordeaux for a short time as an intern. I also worked in, studied in Australia, in South Australia, where actually I know a mutual friend of ours very well, Nick Dugmore of Stoke Wines. Nice. So I was out there at the University of Adelaide for about a year and a half, and I was also working throughout the McLaren Vale, Barossa, Eden Valley, cutting my teeth out there until I moved back to California, where I was in the Central Coast between San Luis Obispo County and Santa Barbara County for a brief time before I moved up to Sonoma and the Lake Counties. And I was working up there for about 2 years until I moved over to Napa, and I was in Napa for a short while. I had a brief stint back in Paso Robles and working within the AVAs out there, predominantly on West Paso side with the larger production stuff for a bit. And then I was over in Virginia for about a year working and managing a vineyard there for just a little over a season and a half until my family and I decided to make our way west, and we ended up in Texas, and now I'm here.
Were you drawn to Texas because of the wine culture there?
I've always had some interest with it. I actually went out in 2000 and I think it was 18 or 19, and I started making contacts out here. I was just kind of curious about just like seeing what was going to take place out here, because I always kind of heard some buzz about Texas growing and the wine industry growing out there. And I don't know, it always just kind of sparked some interest in me. And when we ended up deciding to settle down out here, I wanted to try something different. And I started my own consulting operation, which is Regenerative Agriculture Solutions, which was another, you know, interesting evolution with my timeline of moving all over the place and working in different regions. Was I started to shift my focus and my interest in how I wanted to be a land steward and how I wanted to farm. I started out, out of college, mostly working with large production, more conventional style of farming. And it was like a kind of a slow and subtle shift away from that, where I started to learn a little bit more about organic practices, biodynamics, and then regenerative. And it's probably been the last 2.5 to 3 years I've really taken a major just shift in how I want to, present myself, opportunities for growers who want to work with me, and just, using better land management practices for their vineyards and their operations.
I would love to dig into that.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm gonna just ask you, so 2.5, 3 years in Texas is about what you?
Oh, no. So so I've only been in Texas since August of 2020.
Since August. Okay, great.
Yeah, yeah. But my interest in regenerative.
Predated
that. Yeah, I would say, a major inspiration to me was a mentor and a friend of mine who I met in Napa, who I worked not directly with him, but we worked in the same company. He was in grower relations. I was in the internal management practice of the company. His name's Pete Hoffman. He has a small label out there called Alm Cellars. It's AUM. And Pete had been utilizing minimal intervention practices.
Can I ask you, does he pronounce it Alm or Ohm?
I believe he goes Ohm, and I think I just say Alm because I,
that's the way it looks like when you,
yeah, that's the way it looks like. I read and I go Alm. Oh, okay. Yeah. But yeah,
I just wondered. Yeah. I mean, cause it's, for anyone who knows Ohm, that Ohm. Sanskrit symbol and the, yeah, there's anyway, that might be a little clue into what's going on there.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's all right. So yeah, Pete started explaining all these, at the time when I was learning about it was like obscure practices to me. Cause I was, you know, it was like, oh, you don't till your vineyard every year, or you don't till your vineyard floor, and you're doing like minimal, if any, sprays. Like how are your vines staying healthy with, you know, all the disease pressure that we have in the valley and, you know, this, that, and the other. And he was very imperative about early on teaching me, like, you need to focus on the health of the soil first, and then focus on the immune system and the health of the vine. And if you can build those up, you know, you're going to have a much better chance of not only surviving all the external factors that affect your vineyard and your fruit, but also you're going to have much better quality wine in the long run. Yeah. And, you know, it took time for me to figure out, because I was just like, you know, I had been taught and I'd been, you know, brought up in one way of, you know, not one way, but like the predominant way of thinking at the time. And so, you know, it was like following that, on his little vineyard, cause he's got a couple acres, and then he's very specific on the sourcing of his fruit for all the extra fruit he needs. Like, you know, he was showing me, you know, utilizing, permanent cover crops and bringing in sheep, and, just very minimal intervention processing that, it just kind of lit a light bulb in my head, where I was like, oh man, maybe there's something to this. Maybe this, you know, maybe there's something else I need to look into. Maybe I don't know everything. Maybe I need to relearn some stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And so yeah, that was kind of where the journey began, was with him. You know, I blame him. So,
I've just had a recent interaction about cover crops. It was kind of, you know, to show where people are on a journey. It was like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm so immersed in this vineyard that I'm helping care for here at Piscinas. And it's like, you know, we don't have cover crops. We have like an understory of like, you know, dozens of different varieties of like plant life, you know?
Yeah.
I think the idea, we were sort of describing this because we were at another vineyard talking to the folks there, and they're like, oh, what cover crops did you plant this year? We're like, well, yeah. we didn't, you know, they just reseed and grow back every year, and we never till. And so we just have ongoing evolution of like an understory. It was just like, you know, funny to sort of that idea of like, if you have cover crops, it's because you planted them, you know, in a tilled mm-hmm. system kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so that's really interesting that you had that sort of evolution, and Pete is there. What was before that? Like, what are you close enough to go back to kind of characterize where your mindset was and how you thought about, you know, growing grapes prior to that, like before you started thinking about that, and sort of what some of the specific thoughts were that triggered, you know, you to take a second look at what you were doing and thinking?
Well, yeah. So, you know, I was kind of just brought up in the mindset of it was a very, you know, Model T sort of factory style farming that gets it, you know, it's a very common thing to be said nowadays, especially with the people who are, assisting with educating the masses about, you know, regenerative practices and regenerative farming. And I was one of those farmers who just, you know, we follow the paint by colors, or paint by numbers sort of, steps of farming. And it just, I don't know, it was sort of a gut instinct sort of thing, where I was like, just something doesn't feel right, because, the vines just didn't feel any healthier year after year after year of doing the same things over and over again, having to use like the same chemical inputs and oftentimes even more chemical inputs, because we were, you know, it's like, you have resistance to this, you're not gonna be able to use this thing anymore. We're gonna have to, you know, keep throwing a new chemical formulation or a new piece of machinery or a new, you know, whatever it is, some sort of input, that instead of just focusing on like, well, maybe we're asking the wrong questions, or maybe we're just not searching for what it is that is the root cause. You know, why are the vines having that issue? Why are we constantly having to, you know, put these external, you know, synthetic supplementations in year after year after year, where like, it's just, it's like the vines are dependent or any crop rather than that. It's like the crops just constantly dependent year after year, and they can't be, you know, self-sufficient on their own. And the other interesting thing was like learning that it really does. And like, I credit this to, you know, your boss at Piscinas, Kelly, and a lot of the other pioneers, who really emphasize we need to focus on the soil. And that was never really a major thing. Like I went through soil science and, you know, learning the standard operating procedures learning the basics of what you need to look for when you do a soil test and things like that, but weren't really getting into the heart of like, well, the soil is a living thing and you need to treat it that way. You need to treat it with respect. You need to be nurturing it in a good way, in a good relationship, that it will return back to you. Whereas we were, for so long, I was only treating it like a medium. And, you know, it's like, okay, the soil is depleted in, you know, nitrogen and phosphorus. Okay, we'll just inject more of that and we'll be good to go. And then we'll come back again next year and, you know, rinse and repeat sort of thing. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a lot I want to get into there, but mm-hmm. I think, can you talk about how you thought of the soil if you didn't think of it as a living thing? Like what was,
it was just a home for the roots. I mean, yeah,
like a medium.
It was just a medium, you know, and I think that is the mindset for the most part, where instead of really focusing on, you have billions and billions and billions of microorganisms and species living in that soil that play a vital role in the mutualistic relationship with the plants that you're trying to, cultivate. And it's like, when you have that imbalance, then everything's going to kind of fall apart. You know, it's like what we talk about with, you know, having the bacterial and fungal relationships. You have to find that balance because it's going to play a major part in everything down the food chain.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the problem, is like with the practices that have been implemented for, you know, since at or before the Green Revolution, with the introduction of, you know, ammonia-based fertilizers and stuff, it's just that imbalance has been, you know, causing more and more problems and snowballing over the decades.
Yeah, and you had some training in or focus in IPM, integrated pest management, in your mm-hmm. formal education, mm-hmm. and I think you've sort of let me on that this sort of planted some seeds of like more ecological thinking for you that sort of then, you know, made it almost like a gateway revelation mm-hmm. about this way of thinking. And I'm wondering if you could sort of talk a little bit about that, you know, what you studied and when you started asking questions because of what you were learning.
Yeah. So IPM stands for Integrated Pest Management or Integrated Pest Control. And it's basically a checklist of management practices one will utilize to suppress any sort of a pest that may be affecting your crop, try to keeping it below the economic injury level, the EIL. Initially, you're going to be inspecting your crops, often monitoring, just keeping a close eye on things on a regular scheduled, routine, IDing anything that could be present. So, you know, be it pathogens or insect pests, vertebrate pests, you name it. Following up with monitoring of that ID'd pest and determining what the EIL threshold will be, where you really need to make action happen.
So implicit within that, mm-hmm. I'll just stop to sort of ask questions as, you know, forgive me, but keep your train of thought. But implicit in that, it sounds like, is this idea that first observation is important. Mm-hmm. And second of all, there is a threshold, like just because something is present doesn't mean you have to immediately take action. Like there's a tolerance for balance in a sense, or there's a tolerance for a little more of like, hey, you know, all, you know, just because it lives doesn't mean it's bad. you can, necessarily. Yes. Like, I mean, it depends on when you reach a threshold, like a population level gets to a point where you're going to have economic. And I love that it's economic injury level, that it's not about, it's so less judgmental. I mean, there's something about that, you know, it's not like, oh, it's like we have to eliminate this. It's sort of like, we're going to have economic impact from this now. If that's maybe, and because within that, then is like, maybe if that isn't your only priority, then you can sort of weigh that, like, does the economic injury level, you know, have to cause action? Because, like, maybe you have other priorities depending on the pest that could outweigh that, you know, depending on what the treatment is. Anyway, I'm going too far ahead, but please continue. I just want to, that's kind of a, I can already start to see, my mind is already starting to see how there's like, it's kind of well framed to start thinking about things a little differently, but continue, please. So you have monitoring
and then, so like feeding off of that with what he had mentioned about, you know, the economic injury level, with identifying what the potential pest is, you know, maybe it's at a growth stage or a cycle of its life where, okay, it's present right now, but could be a weather factor, could be a cultural practice that you're going to be applying soon, could be, you know, a biological insect that's native to that area just hasn't quite made its presence yet. So it's one of those things where it's like, maybe nature's just going to take its course and it'll handle it accordingly and you don't have to deal with it at all. You know, it's like not having that approach of like just being, you know, combative for combative's sake, if that makes sense. Just like, oh, well, I see that, I got to take it out. And you're like, maybe that's not always the case, you know? Or maybe, maybe there's a reason, it's a purpose. There's a purpose for that pest being there, you know, and, it's not at a concern right now. And maybe it's actually, there might be a function for it and there's a need for whatever that is, but that's just where the monitoring really is important and just keeping a close eye on it. Then following that, you'll utilize some sort of an action plan. And within those action plans, there's predominantly four action focal subcategories. So you have your cultural practices, your mechanical practices, biocontrol. So that's integrating in, say, like if you have, for example, an insect pest, utilizing predatory pests or natural enemies or beneficials that will target those specific species of insect that are of concern. And then that final one is the, you know, the common one that's of concern most of the time is the chemical approach and having to use that as your final last result if need be. Following the action plan, you would then do an evaluation and you would determine, like, was this effective? Was it not effective? Do I need to go back to the drawing board and reassess what I was doing and try something else? Or is this something I can continue to use? You know, and the main goal is really focusing on trying to, you know, remove that target organism if it is going to be at or, you know, surpassing that EIL threshold, and emphasis on minimizing the damage to your surrounding environment, your plants and your soils. So as I was, you know, being integrated and learning and studying these processes, over time, I started to think about, well, what is it that's, you know, causing the attraction of these pests and causing them to be concerned for the vines? Are there things that we can do in an even more preventative measure to strengthen the microclimate, the environment, the soils, the vines themselves, so they can even have a greater sense of level of defense against any of these potential insects, you know, or pests rather, pathogens. So that's kind of was the one of those initial things that started making me rethink a lot of things and wanting to really learn about, you know, these practices, these regenerative practices that were really starting to come into the conversation and on a widespread level, where I'm like, oh, you know, it's really, in my mindset, it's like setting up your foundation initially to really boost and build up that immune system of that vineyard, of that soil, of that microclimate, to make them as robust as possible so they can, for the most part, be have as little susceptibility as possible, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know any good resources where someone interested in IPM could dig into it more, you know, especially because I know that
definitely,
you know, like Davis has like
the UC IPM.
Yeah, the UC IPM. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's, doesn't it, I mean, you can pretty much, it goes like pest by pest, right? Like you can kind of.
It's always growing. It's catered for the most part for California, but there's a lot of general information on there that's really helpful for even landscape developers, gardeners. And even for commercial operations, it's not just for grapes, you know, it's for, you know, because as you know, California is got a wide variety of orchards and row crops and everything else. And so, it's an amazing resource. There's a lot of great extension programs throughout the country that have sort of similar operations and databases. But I think the Davis UC IPM thing is probably the closest thing to it's probably the best thing out there for, you know, going down that route and trying to integrate those practices into one's operation if they want to, you know, start learning more about this style of management.
Do you know of any other resources for different contexts, maybe like wetter contexts or Texas?
Texas, I would probably go with A&M first and then Texas Tech. They have some great resources available and a lot of free resources, which is really nice too. There's not, for the most part, most of their information is not behind like a paywall or anything. And they have, you know, a lot of extension classes for farmers who are already in place. A lot of extension offices because there are a lot of counties out here. So there's usually an extension office in almost every county. In the East Coast, if you're focusing predominantly with grapes, the information from Cornell is amazing. Virginia Tech has some really great stuff too. Penn State, predominantly a little bit more for table grapes, but Penn State has some really great information out there as well. So,
okay.
Yeah. Nice.
I mean, I want to go back to kind of continuing on this journey. If you want to take us to that final step to where you are now, like what happened and what were the other phases of that journey?
Sure. Yeah. I started to sort of see a lot of these, interesting ecological, scare reports, I guess you could call it, but just showing the massive degradation on a grand scale of like, you know, what conventional farming was doing and where the predictions of where it would lead the future, and it kind of brought a little bit of concern where I was like, you know, I'm only one guy, but is there a way I can start changing the mindset slowly but surely of like, you know, even if I work with one grower and we have really good success with incorporating regenerative practices and we can minimize the use of excessive inputs and target or like our target is to try to like remove all unnecessary inputs, if that's possible, like maybe that will spark a fire with their neighbors and change the mindset as a whole. People will start farming, you know, with more care to the land, more care to their environment, and also putting out better product. That's, you know, ideally, because you know, it's just seeing what the end result is and the end product. Like, I don't know, it's more of a, it's like when I was up at Piscinas with you, it's like when you taste some of these wines that are grown this way, and you feel better, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, it's like compared to a lot of the stuff that you're just, you know, no offense, but it's like some of the just big mass produced stuff, you find it on the grocery store shelf or, you know, your Target or whatever. It's like you drink that stuff and you feel absolutely horrible. And it gives it puts a bad rap for wine itself, where everyone's like, oh, well, wine just makes me sick. And it's like, well, is it the wine or is it wine in general? Or is it, you know, what you're specifically putting in your body, you know,
right,
like that specific product where, It's just mass produced. It's not really made with, you know, actually any care or ease or love. And, you know, it's causing harm to you, causing harm to the environment it's being grown in. Ideally trying to make a shift and a change in a positive direction, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you, so can remind me the name of your business?
Regenerative Agriculture Solutions.
So when you started that about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago?
No. I started that just before we were...
recently?
The idea started just before we were leaving the East Coast. So I had a friend of mine out in the East Coast, and it was kind of funny. He had, I think it was like a couple hundred acres of just great, like just cattle grazing land. And he was already well aware of regenerative practices. He actually leased some land to Joel Salatin for Joel to be able to graze some of his cattle and run some of his chicken tractors on his land and stuff. So it was really nice prime land. And he was like, hey, I want to put 5-6 acres in on my property of some grapevines. And he's like, I just don't know where to begin. He's like, but I want to try and spray as minimally as possible if I don't have to spray at all. And I really want to, you know, are there regenerative practices for viticulture? And I was like, yeah, of course there are. And I said, but it was, I was like, you know, each region is going to have its own specific needs and its own specific tools that are going to work for it. So it's not going to be a one size fits all thing. And so he was actually like my first, you know, unofficial client, where I wrote him up a really cut and dry report. And I just, you know, gave him some suggestions of some really good varieties that would be resistant to a lot of the common diseases out there. Some hybrids and whatnot. It was actually kind of funny because at the time I wasn't as focused on and I didn't really know as well about the Watson system, the trellis system, but I was like, well, you're going to need to use some sort of a sprawling system to open up the canopy, blah, blah, blah. So I brought up the idea of like the Geneva double curtain at first, but then like, it was funny because as I was delving more and more into stuff and examining more of what you guys are doing at Piscinas, then like I went back and I was like, okay, actually, you know what, maybe focus on this Watson system. This might be your better bet out there. And, throwing out some practices and suggestions that I thought would have been really effective for him on his land. And, so at the moment he's slowly, kind of slow to start, but he's in the process of getting things set up. And I think he's going to be establishing that little vineyard, early next year. So it's really cool to see. And I'm, you know, hopefully I can be out there to help him when he gets things started. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
And then, you know, when I got out to Texas, that's when I did the official stuff, the admin, getting the, you know, the business license, the LLC, all that and everything else. So made myself, made the brand officially. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Well, since this is recent, maybe you haven't experienced this, but I'm curious if you have any clients asked you like, what does regenerative mean and what your answer is?
Oh yeah. I haven't got it as much. I did. So Pete and I are working with an individual up in Napa County who has a brand new, or has a family property that's eventually going to be developed. There's a lot of things that need to be in the works right now with it, so it's not officially set. But she asked, you know, what what is regenerative? And it's interesting because, you know, as you know, there's like debate about what the official definition of regenerative is. They're trying to work on it on a state level, and I know the Regenerative Organic Alliance is also working with it to try to make an official definition. But I guess in a very simplistic layman's terms, it's a land management approach, be it ranching or farming or even landscaping, where you're minimizing your excessive and unnecessary inputs and focusing on being as close to I wouldn't say mimicking, but having a mutualistic balance with the surrounding ecosystem and your environment, where things can eventually become a closed loop system and everything will work within benefit of each other, and not being at a combative approach with it. And I'd also add into it, I look at like the approaches with regenerative a lot similar to, say, the debate of, you know, germ theory and terrain theory, if you're familiar with that.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So,
I mean, maybe I am, but
yeah. So there were the school of thought of germ theory and terrain theory, where germ theory was coined by Louis Pasteur, and terrain theory was coined by, I can't remember his first name, but it was I could be wrong. Someone's gonna have to correct me on this, but I believe his name was either Francois Bacamp, or last name was Bacamp. And
okay,
basically it's the thought process with terrain theory that, you know, you need to really focus on the environment around you and really focus on building up the immune system in the environment around you, finding that mutual balance of everything, which will strengthen yourself from, you know, strengthen your internals, your immune system from within, instead of having a immediate combative approach of like, okay, as soon as something's there and something's foreign and it's, you know, going to be potentially an issue, we have to act on it immediately. We have to, you know, put an external input to eradicate it, you know, and take it out. And I think there's there is some kind of similarities to that with, say, looking at regenerative compared to, you know, the standard conventional approach.
Yeah, it's funny. I Googled this. It's Antoine Bichamp.
Thank you.
And
there we go. Yeah.
Of course, the wiki about it is very negative. Like, this pseudo-scientific belief, blah, blah, blah. Like, or, well, it's listed in that, like, an obsolete variation known as terrain theory. And,
oh, of course.
And yet, everything I know about soil and quorum sensing and quorum, you know, quorum signaling suggests that terrain theory has a lot more to it than an obsolete and pseudoscientific basis. in terms of, I mean, I don't know, everything that I seem to be learning is about how the soil, if you see a plant growing, it's telling you something about what's going on in the soil. It's expressing an environmental characteristic. And so nothing's a weed. It's just, it's a communicator. It's telling us stuff.
Yeah. It's telling you, hey, you're at this pH, or there's a, you know, you're probably at this range. You're deficient in this. You're, you know, excessive in, you know, that element. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. It's going back to the mindset of like identifying, looking at it, really getting an understanding before acting immediately. I think there's just too much immediate action where you see something foreign and you're just like, oh, I got to take that out right now. You know, whereas instead of like learning it, getting an idea, okay, like, well, what's my soil actually telling me by presenting this species, you know?
Yeah. If the only thing that you think when you see a species is I have to remove it, rather than asking why it's there and what it's telling me and what that says about my management and the needs of the land, then you're just going to keep trying to remove it indefinitely because it's going to keep coming back until you learn.
Exactly.
You know, it's going to keep giving you that opportunity to ask those questions. So you better ask them the first time.
Yeah. And that's the other thing that is was one of the big light bulb moments with me was, you know, like we, in the past, you know, we would utilize this array of cocktail chemicals throughout the growing season. And you would never be at complete eradication, right? You'd always have a percentage that would come back. And then that percentage would have the resistant evolutionary gene. And then it would, and then it would grow from the next year and the next year and the next year. And so the mindset was, oh, well, we just need to hit it with something stronger.
Yep.
We just need, and then you're like, no, you're just going to continually reinvent the wheel and you're just going to create more resistance by doing that. Like you got to go back and you got to start asking, well, why is it here in the first place? Like, just like you said, yeah, why is it here in the first place? And what is it telling me? What is it that needs to be addressed and fixed from the get-go?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you talked about was the Watson trellis system. And this was one of the things that I was going to spring on you, not just the Watson, but I've been thinking a lot more about the benefits of an elevated trellising system, because VSP is so dominant. So I'd love you to talk about what you've seen and observed and just the instinct. But I mean, to me, there's so many benefits. So I'm just observing here in the vineyard that I'm working with. And, you know, we've had some heavy frost, even though this is a elevated vineyard up on a hilltop, the slope, it slopes in all directions for the most part. There's maybe a pocket that's sort of a little, depression, and not like a full on slope. But even on those slopes, and we've had heavy enough frosts in the past couple of weeks where everything below 30 inches just got fried, any growth below 30 inches on the vines is crisped, brown. We hope it'll grow back, but we don't know. And above that, everything above that is beautiful. And it's just like, clearly if we had had everything trained at like a 30 inch grow wire and things were just sprouting out, we would have lost like a whole lot of the crop this year, it would have been really devastating. The fact that everything's at 66 to 68 inches makes it, actually functionally possible to do things. And that's just one thing. I mean, there's so many other benefits for that, like airflow, and reducing fungal pressure because of airflow. I could go on, but I'm just curious what you've noticed about sort of an elevated, it doesn't have to be Watson, but there's a lot of top wire cordon.
I think the VSP system is interesting. It's very effective for uniformity. It's very effective for doing
mechanical harvesting,
mechanical operations, which seems to be the way a lot of farming practices are going to be shifting for the larger acreage operations in California, because of the challenges with labor costs and whatnot. You see a lot of these operations that are now, and this is the sad thing, it's turning into that Model T thing like we were talking about, where it's like you're not even having, for the most part, humans in the vineyard anymore. You might have one guy driving a multi-use piece of machinery throughout the whole season, or not even that. I mean, it's now there's just the autonomous tractors now are starting to be implemented, right. Which it's like I don't want to downplay the innovations of technology. I think there is always going to be a place to utilize new technologies and new things in the vineyard that can enhance and help with management practices, like the new sensor systems that are out there that really give you a more real up-to-date, real-time view of what's going on underneath the soil or within the vine or whatever, just as an example. But it is kind of it's kind of sad to see sometimes where it's just like everything's just getting so cut and dry, mechanical. It's like you're kind of losing the soul of the farming, you basically just have no humans left in there. But anyway, sorry, I'm digressing. The VSP system, it has its efficiencies, but I think, like you said, it's been utilized and overutilized so much that it's either people are, growers are scared to try something different. They're scared to experiment. Or they just don't know what else is out there. They just don't think that there are other possibilities, that you can experiment, you can try other things. And maybe there's something out there that you never thought about that, the concept that we were talking about when I was up at Piscinas with you guys was thinking outside the box, trying something else. I think the Watson system or any of the high sprawl systems are fascinating because, to be honest, like as we talked about with the vine, it wants to climb and it wants to sprawl, and it's sort of kind of thinking about it, like you're putting it in a bit of a confined situation when you put them in those really collapsed controlled VSP system in a sense.
Yeah.
Whereas like evolution, the evolution of the vine, it really does want to sprawl and expand out. And if you can assist it where it makes it a, you know, have a more advantageous, mimicking way of growing like that with that sprawling system, it probably brings out more beneficial characteristics and traits to it. I mean, I'd be curious to see like if there's a comparison of like, you know, using, if like you used all the same practices on a VSP system and a sprawl system and see if like, the sprawl system has a greater, plant Brix level for pest resistance and overall health. I'd be kind of curious to see if that would be the case. It's interesting because like, so with the Watson system out here, as you know, it was originated in Texas and, I think it has a lot of great benefits out here. I would love to see it utilized even more, than it is. Cause, depending on the region you're at or the AVA in Texas that you're at, I mean, it'll be, high wire single sprawl or, VSP to an extent. And, there are definitely some areas for sure that are using, they're still using Watson, but, I'd love to see it utilized more, because of all the great attributes it has available to it, with the raised canopy, not having as much of a risk of frost damage at the base level during spring frost, with the sprawling out, it has a little bit more protection, especially with the hail, because hail is a big problem out here. I think that sprawling out of the canopy later in the season protects the grapes a bit more. And, it still would need to utilize some sort of a hail netting aspect, but it'd probably be a little bit easier for an application of that. And the reduced risk of just like overall grape clumping as well, where, the grapes, they hang at a much, much more
open,
evenly spaced, open situation. So yeah, you get better sun exposure, you get better wind flow, like you said, which is going to reduce a lot of potential disease pressure.
Yeah, the clusters sort of hang free and loose, not like in the same like column with the canes and the leaves and everything else and the shade. They will be in dappled shade, and in a sense, like you said, that might even afford some protection for like a lighter hail.
Yeah,
and also provides, sun protection as things heat up, and that sprawl, that managed sprawl, it gives you shade, which actually cools the soil, cools the ground below the vines as well, and creates a whole microclimate. And I mean, which is something that which is beneficial a lot of times. Of course, shade is where fungi sort of, love to be as well. So there's like that balance, but like you said, there's airflow. Do you think about shade management in vineyards? Like, is there a term shade management, or is that, I'm talking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it kind of depends on how you're establishing and setting up your trellising system. Of course, like your row and vine spacing is going to have a major effect on that. And then as well, the other big aspect is, do you need the shade management if you're keeping a permanent cover on the soil floor?
It'll help that cover grow better for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it'll help you keep it moister, keep it cooler, and allow for more growth of that understory, which seems beneficial to a certain, to me it does. I know a lot of people get scared of understory growth, but
yeah, of course, it's
another great reason for elevated. You can
another great
not
reason
stress
for
so much. Like, yeah, you can have 36 inch high understory, and you haven't even reached the grapes.
Exactly.
Yeah. You'd be wading through thick, lush cover crop, and it's there's another thing I wanted to ask you about. I'm kind of jumping around, but things that I feel like you, as in given sort of depth of experience in the management and consultation that you do, to me, I've been thinking a lot about dormant season spraying and how even if I was growing hybrids in California, for example, where I don't think I would need to spray them very often, I might consider like one dormant season spray. And my thinking is this, like, you're spraying, like I would spray after pruning, before bud break even, or, right at Budbreak or something like that. But basically, you don't have all this growth. So you're spraying a lot less material, right? Yep. So you're putting less stuff out there in the world, yep. but you're also being much more effective at it because you could like potentially use something to sort of knock back the spore load that overwinters on the trunk and cordon and, mm-hmm. you know, basically have a reset to start the season with right before all those populations start to explode and reproduce. Do you, I don't know, does that ring true with you? Is that something am I thinking correctly?
It definitely does, especially if you're in areas where you're not getting like that early season, you're not getting a lot of direct sunlight in the morning to burn off right. some of that stuff. And you're getting that marine layer where you're in a muggy
heavy dew morning.
The early dew mornings, cause you got to think about, you might have some early powdery mildew pressure that comes about, but the big ones obviously are Phomopsis and Anthracnose. So you gotta address those early on, cause those are going to be your early season, fungal pathogens that are going to affect your right. early growth. And, you know, kind of thinking about it, like if you don't take care of the early growth, it could really make that season, you know, at the start, a real struggle for the vines to really get established and get the new shoots really established in the canopy and everything. So, yeah, I don't think there's...
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, I have no problem with it. Yeah.
In terms of organic substances that you might use as dormant spray, do you have any recommendations or list of things that are good?
I mean, copper sulfate is an organic, but you got to be careful with it, obviously, because, you know, too much copper toxicity is going to be bad for your soil. There are some other products, like there's a lime sulfur product that's out there that can be utilized. That's very good. I would recommend a lot of those. I mean, even early season stylet oils to a very controlled extent would be okay. But you just have to be, you just have to be careful with when you're using those things and just be mindful of like not being completely reliant on them year after year, maybe trying them out. And then, you know, again, it's like going back and trying them out and then evaluating like, okay, we had some good effect with that, you know, but what are the potential ramifications that could happen by utilizing that? Like what other processes could be affected negatively by using that for that target spray?
Right. Yeah, because stylet oil can affect some of the insect life. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's like one of those things you got to be careful with if you're wanting to establish your beneficials for early spring and you're doing a dormant spray. Like, okay, what's that going to do with your pollinators and your other beneficial insects that are going to be there for, you know, protection for any potential pest insects that might be just overwintering and not quite hatching out yet.
And I know you've been thinking a lot about sap analysis and Brix content in vines. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it was kind of relatively recently I really started focusing in on that, and it was definitely emboldened after the lectures that Kelly gave on it and what everyone, you know, y'all at Piscinus are doing, because I really want to utilize the sap flow analysis in place of standard tissue analysis this year with clients who are interested, because I find it just, I don't know, I just find it like it could be a much better, more effective and efficient way of really getting a better glimpse at how the vine is handling the growing season. And and the raising the plant Brix for resistance too and longevity, especially with the risk of piercing sucking insects and whatnot. That was just fascinating. It was kind of one of those things where it's like I know I had heard about it before, but I never really gave it some thought. And then kind of hearing it again at Piscinus, I just was like, okay, I really got to look in on this more, and I gotta do a deeper dive, because that kind of strengthens a lot of my preconceived thoughts and mindset about really building up the immunity of the vine, because that's essentially what it is. Like you get to that that level of a strength within the vine, they're going to be very resilient, and it's going to.
And just if we can step back, so like, I mean, I'm sure wine makers, wine people in general, think of bricks in relation to, you know, when you're harvesting grapes and you're measuring sugar content in fruit, and you know, other people who measure fruit, you know, any kind of grapes or apples or pears or any kind of fruit that you're making wine with or eating. Yeah. But what we're talking about is actually the, like, crushing up a leaf and measuring the bricks of the juice that you express from, like, a leaf from your apple tree or grapevine. And what the findings are, if I mean, you jump in and correct me, but from what I've read and what I can remember is, you know, once you reach a certain threshold over like 16 bricks in your sap, essentially like bugs don't want to eat it. Don't want to like suck, like the leaf suckers don't want to suck your vines anymore. Is that, and other pests sort of fall away as well.
I think it's from what I have a basic understanding of it. I think it's like, it just builds up so much, you know, strong positive pressure within the phloem, that, when those piercing sucking insects want to try. And I would guess, I don't know for sure, but I want to believe that there's probably some sort of aspect that the plants are also, cause you know, they're sentient beings just like us, where they're giving off signals and communication to the other plants, and they're giving off defensive chemical hormones and whatnot. They're probably giving off some sort of, you know, warning signal to the insects, like, hey, this is going to be a really hard time for you if you try to feed on me. You know? And the insects are, if they're able to be mobile, they're probably like, okay, well, let's try to find one that's not giving off that single signal, and they're going to go and search for the weak one that's, you know, its neighbor or something. And I think that's what it comes down to.
And it goes hand in hand with sort of vine health, as you were saying, where they're finding that insects are preying on the sort of weakened or the vines, or you know, the plants that are doing poorly, and that's actually attracts the insects into them. So it's like maintaining this health and bolstering this health. And how would you do that? What are you finding works to bolster health?
Well, I think it starts with the foundation. Really knowing, like, when you're establishing and setting up your vineyard, knowing in and out your soil type, and not just your soil type, like, you know, what the active organic matter is, what the, you know, compaction level is. This is going to be, you know, pH, available nutrients within the soil. Setting yourself up for success, setting it up where, like we talked about with regenerative practices, it's just a toolbox. It's not a one size fits all approach. So you're really focusing on what aspects I need to utilize. So be it, you know, your trellising system, your plant selection. Maybe you're in an area that would probably do better with hybrids than, you know, purely vinifera.
If your vines are constantly, you know, succumbing to fungal pressures because you're growing the wrong kind of plant, or maybe it's, you know, maybe vines in general aren't the thing to grow.
Maybe
you know, if you're constantly having drought stressed plants, they're going to be more susceptible to everything, right? Like all the other issues, like when they're struggling in one way, they're going to start struggling in other ways. They become susceptible. So you want the right thing adapted to that climate, so that they don't have that baseline struggle of just trying to be able to deal with what that climate throws at it, in addition to, you know, all the other stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, it's like, if you already have mutualistically beneficial native plants that are already established there, you know, maybe you don't have to be putting in external, you know, cover crop varieties. Maybe you can just keep those in, or maybe you have to bring in external cover crop varieties to help complement, you know, things that are not as available, or, you know, chelated in the soil that need to be freed up and released. So I think it really comes down to the initial foundation, and this is the hard thing too. It's like, sometimes the correct answer might not always be the popular answer, you know, which is sometimes the case with things, where it's like, well, this, you know, obscure variety would do really well out here, but the market says that everyone wants, you know, this popular variety, but that popular variety is going to be a real nightmare to try to establish, you know, just like a simplistic answer to it. But
right.
Yeah. It's like the,
Well, you worked in Virginia. I mean, did that ever happen in Virginia?
Virginia was interesting because there was, there was, you know, some interesting use of some hybrids and whatnot out there. And,
Great.
They were very successful. Very, you know, very good. But, you know, there were some other challenges. I mean, there was, you know, there were pockets of the state where you could establish, like you were able to establish, you know, certain Bordeaux varieties and whatnot, but it was still a challenge.
Right.
And
yeah, that's what I've think of more as the norm where it's trying to build. Anyway, yeah. I won't pick on.
Oh, Virginia. No, it's all right. I was listening to your previous or the most recent podcast earlier about the Foxy wines. And I was like, yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head. Like you put this stigma out initially and everyone just takes it and runs with it. And it's like, well, most of the time, the people who are criticizing some of these, you know, native vine varieties or hybrid vine varieties, like, have they actually really delved into it, or are they just playing telephone and just listening to what someone, you know, quote unquote expert, you know, specialist is just telling them what to think and how to, what to think and how to drink, basically.
Yeah. And that misinformation is so pervasive. It's very easy somebody who, you know, to just believe it without, you know, if you're not going to be critically, I mean, there's nothing really other than like my episode to really challenge that idea of like what is disseminated out there en masse, unless you've actually worked directly with these things and spent some time thinking about like, hey, this is not at all what I expected.
Oh, exactly. And it's interesting too, because then you have like with a lot of the times when you get presented with an alternative to what your preconceived thought process was, you're either going to hardline it and you're just going to stick with what your initial beliefs were, or you're going to go, you know what, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I need to rethink some things and reassess. And, we talked about it briefly beforehand. Or not here, but when, you know, last time I chatted with you, and I do think there's a major shift happening with the wine consumer now.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a lot more open, openness to alternatives, alternative varieties, alternative, obscure in the sense of like, oh, well, it's not what's been established for the last, you know, few decades or whatever. I think there's going to be a major shift in the foreseeable future where, you know, as people are being, or the consumer is starting to really ask more questions about, you know, the land management, the growing practices, you know, questions that weren't as focused on a mainstream level in the past. Now people are asking those questions more. And I think it's going to make a shift where it's going to become probably more widely accepted to utilize certain varieties and, you know, certain obscure, or lesser known varieties that, were not as popular in the past, because they're going to be able to handle the changes in the climate much better. And the, you know, they're going to be better suited for, you know, certain microclimates that initially probably weren't, you know, ideal for the standard varieties that were, you know, in place for so long.
Yeah. I think more and more, you know, how cool it would be if the wine culture wasn't a culture of like trying to preserve this very narrow and stagnant thing, but that it became a culture, like the culture was a process of adaptation, you know, that's what it is. So it just means we're going to embrace change and follow that where we're going. But, you know, and I'm glad that you're on that journey as well. And what's your range in terms of clientele? Like how far are you just Texas based at the moment?
There's a potential development that's going to be happening in Northern California. I'm just waiting on, waiting for the process to unfold with, some stuff on the owner's end. Yeah, predominantly I'm going to be Texas based, stretching from. So for the grow, for listeners who don't know much about Texas wine, Texas has 8 designated AVAs. And if you want, I can go through all 8 of them if very briefly if you want.
But, yeah, please.
Yeah, so the most popular one, it's the 3rd largest AVA in the US, is the Hill Country. I think it's what is it? Probably 9 million acres, but not, it's only a small fraction of that that's actually planted. Within that Hill Country AVA, there's 2 other AVAs. There's the Bell Mountain, which was the first AVA in Texas that was designated. I think it was 85 or 86. I'd have to look back on my on the actual records of it. Then you have Fredericksburg. There's the High Plains, which is in spanning outside of Lubbock and West Texas, which is the largest planted acreage. So that produces most, or that is where most of the grapes in Texas are grown. Following that, we also have Escondido, Mesilla Valley, Texas Davis Mountains, and Texoma, which is the one AVA that I'm closest to, being closer to Oklahoma and North Texas.
Texoma, okay.
Texoma, yeah. So all, and it's very, very diverse, very different microclimates throughout. So like as you're it's closer to wet, big state, you're closer to West Texas, it's going to be Escondido and Mesilla are a little bit higher in elevation, same with High Plains. So, and it's a bit more of a desert appellation too. So you're going to be dealing with a lot more extreme cold, extreme heat. They have a bit more of a risk of, they get quite a bit of hail too. Disease pressure is not as big, or not as much of a concern out there. As you move towards Central Texas and East Texas, that's where you're getting a lot more humidity, and you get a lot more you get more rainfall than West Texas, obviously. But you're also dealing with a lot. I would say it not as comparable to the disease pressure of the East Coast, but it definitely has a fair bit. It's like middle road between California disease pressure and East Coast disease pressure, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and your website is regenerativeagsolutions.com. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Regenerativeagsolutions.com. Cool. Is there any closing words? Did I not ask you something that I should have asked you?
No, I think we covered all of our bases and then some. this was really great then. I want to say I thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to have a platform to talk with you today. I really appreciated it. And I hope we just can continue to grow this new, well, I don't want to say new, it's grow this traditional way of thinking, but to the new mindset out there.
Yeah. Maybe like revive the traditional revive way of it. Thinking. Yeah,
exactly. Revive the holistic traditional way of thinking. So yeah. I truly appreciate it, Adam.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really well said. Thanks. Really appreciate it. Well, that's all, folks. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I really think that Nick's journey is inspiring, and his desire to share it is really inspiring, because it's, I think, one of the things that I was thinking about is how you hear about people like Nick who start farming in a certain way and then learn and change, and they take a better path. They take a more regenerative approach to life and to thinking about how we can manage the world that we live in, how we can manage our lives in this world. And they don't go back. Like, you don't hear about things going in the other direction. And that's really hopeful. You don't hear about people who are hardcore regenerative sort of, having this epiphany that conventional is the way to go. Conventional is the future. And I know that sounds really silly, but if you think about it, that's really hopeful. That's really encouraging. And it gives me a lot of hope anyway. And just along those lines, I have a couple book recommendations for you. I've been thinking a lot about, I said at the beginning about how every situation
you can almost say it depends. You know, there are nuances, there are complexities to every context that we're in, to every farm that we farm. There's different ways to approach it, and it's not going to work the same for everybody. This individuality is something that I think we're beginning to realize is true for so many things, and animals and birds are something that have been on my mind in this especially. I've been talking to the ravens in the vineyard here because we trap gophers and things like that, and I've been whistling to the ravens to let them know that I have a gopher for them, and they've been responding, and now they know when I whistle a certain way to come and have dinner. And it's been really cool. Watching these birds fly, they soar, they flip under their backs, they talk, they fight, you know, they mate, they have incredible personalities. Like, I haven't been able to distinguish them yet because I haven't spent enough time in close proximity to them. But seeing their individuality, seeing their joy, like, they are not these biological machines that are just responding to stimuli. They are absolutely living with joy. It's really amazing when they fly by. I think they feel sorry for us, like, because we're just stuck down in our heavy boots on the ground, you know, between the vines, and they can dip and swerve, and they don't even have to beat their wings barely, and they just soar through, flip onto their back just for fun, you know, kicking it. It's incredible. Anyway, the books that I've read along these lines, Wesley the Owl. And Wesley the Owl, if you haven't read it, is this incredible story of a woman who raises a barn owl, which had a nerve damage wing and was not going to survive in the wild, so she took it and raised it as her own, you know, charge, and through its entire life. And so it is actually an incredibly heartfelt, beautiful story about finding the individuality in this other being. It's great for the whole family, and, you know, does have a sad ending, as all stories about, you know, things that have shorter lifespans than us do, but it's incredibly inspirational. And one of the really amazing takeaways that I had from it was just how many things we miss in the day-to-day basis, how much we're unaware of. And this was a repeated thing in this book that you'll have to read to see why it is, but that awareness is something I've been thinking a lot about, especially as I work in a vineyard and I'm surrounded by all these birds living their individual lives. And, you know, I mean, I literally see eagles every day if I pay attention, and multiple different kinds of eagles some days. And it's an incredible place where if I didn't pay attention, I could miss so many things. Eagles, by the way, are coming back. They're finding in many areas, eagles are returning. I was just in New York, and apparently there are bald eagles coming out their ears there now, which is also really encouraging. Like, things are moving because of smart decisions and because of people going on journeys like the one that Nick has taken. We're actually seeing the results of that. And that brings up this other book that I read, which is not probably good for the whole family. Like, do not read this with your kids, but it's called The Tiger, A Story of Revenge and Survival. And it is a great companion to Wesley the Owl, but, you know, again, not necessarily for kids, whereas Wesley would be fantastic for kids. The Tiger is about a hunt for a man-eating or human-eating tiger in the taiga, which is also kind of confusing for me to say that, but it's anyway the far eastern part of Russia. It's an incredible tale, because in the course of this hunt for this tiger that eats people, they themselves become hunted. And it's not just a story about hunting. It's much more a story along the lines of Wesley the Owl and learning about the tiger and why the tiger is doing what it's doing and the situation that it's in. And one of the great things about it is tiger populations, and this isn't the great thing, but this is the bad thing, which is tiger populations have been on the decline everywhere globally. And finally, because of some concerted effort between Chinese and Russian governments, they're starting to see a revival of the populations, or some evidence that the populations are on the rebound after reaching a low of maybe 400 tigers total in that area. Anyway, Two great books, highly recommend for for many reasons. I haven't spoiled anything for you, and they're both great to listen to as audiobooks as well. And so thanks everybody who supports this podcast. I know it's a weird transition to go from book recommendations, but I am so grateful to be able to share these things with you, be able to share Nick with you and his journey. And those of you who support this podcast, you know, financially and in other ways, really make it possible. So thank you so much. And if you are interested in supporting, you can do that by going to the support page at beyondorganicwine.com and seeing a whole list of ways that you can support. And do whatever one seems best to you. Some of them can take you 5 seconds. Others, you know, you could subscribe to our Patreon channel. Thank you so much. Enjoy.